Good morning, everybody. It is about 7:40 here at the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High sitting in studio with you. And it is now time, as it is every Wednesday, it is time for Green Side Up. Our friends from the K-State Extension Office are here today. It's Jacob Weber and Cherry Nelson. Guys, how are you doing today?
Very well. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Well, Jacob, we'll go ahead and get to you and a few things that you wanted to discuss today. And the first thing is you were telling me, and I mispronounced it earlier, but I think I got it now, twig girdlers.
Twig girdlers. That's right. And this is a time of the year when we start getting calls about small branches laying on the ground. Numerous small branches on the ground look like they've been cut off with a nice little smooth cut, except for a little bit of a stub in the center that had broken off. And a lot of folks wonder, what did this? What's doing this? Is my tree going to suffer irreparable damage? The answer is it's done by a female insect. We call it the twig girdler. It's actually a beetle, a cerambycid beetle, a longhorn beetle. We call it longhorn because they have long antennae that actually go stretch clear back past the end of their tail. The reason that the insect is doing this is because she's laid eggs in that little branch. That branch, of course, the diameter of that branch is not going to exceed more than, it's less than 3/8 of an inch in diameter. And the reason for that is because the mandibles, the jaws of the insect can't reach too far into the wood. They're only going to go in about maybe an eighth of an inch, and so she's going to cut a notch all the way around that twig, and the twig remains in the tree for several weeks, maybe actually up to 6 weeks. The reason that the notch is cut in the tree is to stop this flow of sap to the end of the branch. She's laid eggs in that branch, and a sap-filled branch will kill the newly developing larvae that are going to hatch out from those eggs. Another reason is that branch is going to fall on the ground, and eventually the larvae will consume the inner bark tissue or inner twig tissue and reach full size. And then from that point, it will emerge from that branch and go into the soil, form a little cocoon or an area where it will pupate and emerge as an adult insect the following spring, summer. Then they will feed and then mate, and the process continues for next year. It's a one-year cycle. There's no point in getting too excited about the twig girdler unless, of course, you're a commercial pecan grower, where the ends of the branches are the productive areas of the tree itself, the part that's going to produce next year's nut crop. And if you have an insect that is cutting off the branches, the ends of the branches, the small branches, you're going to see a reduction in pecan production. But the twig girdler is not purposely controlled and pecan orchards, because other insects are being sprayed and controlled at that time, so it takes care of two problems at one time. Twig girdler, small branches, this is another gee whiz thing. You put your hands in your pocket and say gee whiz. If you want to, well, obviously you're going to pick up the branches and get rid of them. You're probably going to throw them in a burn pile and burn them. That takes care of the insect. But that does not control the insect, because there's lots of areas where the branches will fall, and they will the insect will complete its life cycle. And the twig girdler is a strong flyer, so if you have cleaned everything up in your yard, you're still going to get them next year, because they're going to fly in from other places. It's just one of those things. It's just like I said, gee whiz.
It's kind of hard to control because I mean they're small animals to begin with, so it's just
but as you said,
you know, they burrow what, 3/8 of an inch. Well, and that's not very big if you think about that. That's tiny.
They cut a notch. It's just a nice smooth notch, like a little beaver. It cuts a notch and it's smooth. And you pick that branch up and you look at it. Something cut it off. And that's right. It's an insect. I like to hit on the fact that it's a female insect thing, because the male insect has no need of doing it because it doesn't lay eggs.
Right.
Just like a mosquito, the male insect has no need of blood because it doesn't have to produce eggs. So it's the females that are... Now, Cherry's not smiling.
All right. Well, moving on here, you were wanted to talk about taking care of a newly put down a fescue or fertilizing fescue grass.
Okay, fall's the time of the year to fertilize fescue lawns. It's also the time of the year when some folks plant a new fescue lawn or maybe overseed a fescue lawn. We're talking about taking care of that newly emerging grass that's coming up now. If we didn't have frequent rainfalls, we would be thinking about possibly irrigating the lawn. But I guess we don't have to do that this year, not in this area.
That's for sure.
Yeah, because the irrigation is being taken care of all by itself, by Mother Nature. And she's doing an excellent job this year, by the way, of keeping everything watered, actually, to the point where, we feel like we might be drowning a little bit. But the fescue grass, of course, it needs to become established when that new seedling plant comes up. It's interesting. When we plant a bean seed, that plant starts to grow, and its roots that come out are its main root system. It is taken off, and those roots are going to develop off of that main radical, that new root that sets down. Grass plants, they have what's called a primary and a secondary root system. The primary root is pretty wimpy. It just there to get help get the grass plant established. Grasses produce a secondary root system. It actually is adventitious roots that develop at the first node, and that's what is going to become the permanent root system of the grass plant. So in this process, you have to keep the soil moist until that secondary root system becomes established. Actually, grass does very well if it has adequate moisture all the time. That newly developing grass plant, irrigation is very important, except for this year. And then also having an adequate level of nitrogen in that soil, not an excessive amount, but just enough. It would be beneficial, of course, to maybe lightly fertilize that grass as it's starting to grow and develop. And, of course, keep the lawnmower ready, because once that grass is tall enough to mow, it should be mowed. You shouldn't let it get tall enough to where it starts to flop over. Those first blades are going to be fairly slender and very flexible. And if they get any height to them at all, they're going to lay over and mat down. And that may create some issues with a developing grass plant. So go out and mow it. Don't be afraid to mow the grass. That stimulates leaf growth, and it helps that plant develop a crown, or a good quality crown. We'd like to have the grass plants up and growing here right now. But it's not too late to overseed or plant grass yet. We'd like to cut that off if we're going to overseed or plant a lawn. It should be done by early October, so that allows for at least a month or 6 weeks of active growth to develop that secondary root system. But the later we delay, or longer we delay planting grass, it's going to actually increase the risk of losing a lot of those grass plants over the winter, because that primary root system is not going to sustain that grass plant through the winter, especially if we have freezing and thawing cycles where that primary root is going to be stretched a little bit. It'll pop, and then the grass plant dies.
Yeah, so like you said, don't be afraid to mow that grass once it gets to the point where you can mow it. That way you can have nice, thick grass, because like you said, it helps stimulate growth on the leaves. And so that's a good thing to hear. Moving on, planting trees.
Planting trees.
And you said sometimes some people like to plant trees in fall, what are your ideas on planting trees?
Well, I just think more about shopping for a tree. Fall's a pretty fair time to plant trees, but shopping for trees in the fall or any time of the year, this applies for spring as well. When you're shopping for container-grown or field-grown ball and burlap trees, my recommendation is you'd like to see a nice top on it. Maybe some folks prefer a taller tree, maybe in the range of 8 to 10 foot tall. I suggest maybe shopping for not so large of a tree, but the really important part of the tree is not the above ground part, but the below ground part, the root system. Trees need an adequate size root system to support the top. And it's been my experience that there are some fairly cheap trees that have not or do not have an adequate size root system, and they have a tendency to have a struggle to actually become established. So when you are shopping for trees, look at the roots and look for adequate size. American standard for nursery stock. The recommendation is for a 1-inch caliper tree, that the caliper is measured at 6 inches above the soil line. It's the diameter of the trunk, and that would be a tree maybe in a range of 5 to 7 feet tall. The diameter of that root ball should be at a minimum 18 inches. Yeah, or if it's a container-grown tree, it should be in a container of approximately 5 gallons or larger in size.
Well, Jacob, we do have somebody calling in. If you go up to take a call, and caller, you are on Greenside Up. How are you doing today? Yes, caller, are you there? Let's see. Okay, caller, for some reason, cannot hear the phone. Let's try that again. Okay, so that's not working right now. So we'll try to get back to that here in a bit. Let's go ahead and take a quick break, and I'll see if I can't get the phone lines fixed here in just a few minutes. You are listening to Greenside Up right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Welcome back to the Mighty 690K GGF. Kyle High sitting here with you. It is Greenside Up with Jacob Weber and also Cherry Nelson. And now we'll see if we can't get this, see if we can't get the caller on the line. And caller, you are on Greenside Up. How are you doing this morning? And let's see. Okay. Caller, you're on Greenside Up. How are you doing this morning? Okay, finally we were able to get you. I had no idea what was going on there. Do you have a question for Jacob?
Not now. Don't bother. You got a lot of growth. Did you, by the way, pinch those those primocanes when they're about 40 inches tall, 36 to 40 inches tall? Okay, that's what happens. Those canes are really going to grow long, and they're going to be strung out far. So you can grow blackberries that way. You don't have to grow them or pinch them. Thornless blackberries, they have an erect, semi-erect stem. So if you pinch at about 36 to 40 inches, that stem will be strong enough to hold a plant up, and then you get lateral shoot development. But you don't have that. You have maybe a few laterals possibly have developed now. Your blackberry fruit production is going to be out on that longer part of the stem. So if you cut it off, you're cutting off next year's crop. So you can trim it back a little bit. I would say trim the cane back maybe 8 feet long, 6 to 8 feet long, and then tie it up to a wire to hold it up in above the ground, because if you don't, your blackberries are going to be on the ground. They're going to get messed up and probably decay. Put a wire maybe about 30 inches above the ground, 36 inches above the ground, a good sturdy wire. Several posts to hold that wire up. We're talking a wire at least 12 gauge or maybe a 10 gauge wire, a good stiff wire that's going to support a good weight, and then tie the canes to that wire, and that will be your crop for next year. Of course, the cane's going to overwinter. It's going to vernalize. Those buds are going to come out next spring and produce shoots that are going to have flowers on them. That's called a floricane. After next year's crop is produced on that particular cane, you cut it off to the ground. You remove it because it's going to die. It won't produce any more fruit. Next year, you're going to get new canes come up, and those are going to be primal canes. When they get about 40 inches tall, pinch off about an inch and a half of the tip. And you can do that with your fingers. That's why it's called a pinch. It's soft tissue. You just pop it off, and that'll produce laterals. And then from those laterals, you do some pruning during the winter months. You prune the laterals back to about 18 inches long, and then tie that cane to the wire so it holds it up, and that way you get your fruit up in the air. So, okay. Nope, I wouldn't bother, okay? Yep.
All right, thank you, caller, for calling. Let's go ahead and hit our top of the hour. When we come back, we will have Cherry Nelson, and she will talk about all the great things 4-H is doing in upcoming events right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Welcome back to Greenside Up right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High sitting with you, and also sitting in studio with me is Jacob Weber and Cherry Nelson. And we want to talk to Cherry right now as she is talking about 4-H Week. Cherry, good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fantastic. Let's hear all about all the great things 4-H is doing.
Well, we are getting ready to kick off our new 4-H year. 4-H enrollment will, new year enrollment starts next week on October 1st. That system will be open. So to kick off that, we will have National 4-H Week starting October 6th through the 12th. There's going to be a lot of things going on around the country. There's over 6 million 4-H members worldwide. In Wildcat District, we have 700 members, 4-H members in our district. Those members will do various things during National 4-H Week. It culminates with 48 Hours of 4-H, which is a community service project activity that the 4-H members can do. They might be cleaning yards, they might be doing food banks, could be anything. I know in Wilson County, we're going to be doing we're going to have a fall family kickoff event, just kind of to get new people out to see what 4-H is all about, and get the old members out to have a good time and teach people about 4-H.
So just getting out in the community and helping out in the community.
Yeah, that's what a lot of the National 4-H Week will be about. As I said, we had a pumpkin growing contest this past summer, and the 4-H kids came and they picked up seeds. They had to plant certain seeds that were provided, and those seeds were planted, and we're getting ready to have our contest to see who grew the largest pumpkins. And I've talked to several members here this last week, and they're excited. They think they have the biggest pumpkin, and so we're going to see. And then some of the members are going to give presentations about how they grew their pumpkins and the issues they ran into. This year, big issue was pumpkin seeds flooding out or getting washed out after they planted them and things like that. So a lot going on with the 4-H stuff coming up, so we're looking forward to having a great week with National 4-H Week. And some of the clubs will put, you might see some decorated windows, participation in parades coming up and things like that. So a lot of stuff going on.
So yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a very active week for you guys. And if anybody has questions about 4-H Week, how can they contact you?
Well, they can get a hold of us on our website, thewildcatdistrict.ksu.edu. There's a lot of information about 4-H on there, or they can contact our local offices. Myself, I'm in the Wilson County Fredonia office. They can contact me at 620-378-2167. Always happy to talk about 4-H and what that can provide to the kids. We just wrapped up the state fair here a couple weeks ago. Wildcat District had a lot of kids that participated out there, and they represented their district and the area well, with not just livestock, but all kinds of good stuff. So,
yeah, that's always great to see. I remember when I was a kid, when I grew up in Oklahoma City, we had a ton of kids that would, you would see a ton of 4-H kids at the Oklahoma State Fair, and it was just so great to see. I lost my train of thought real quick. What are the other things that 4-H basically does for the community?
4-H does a lot of things for the community. I think the big thing that 4-H accomplishes for the community is developing new leaders that are going to be leading the communities. The kids get the opportunities to run meetings. They learn a lot about parliamentary procedure, how to properly make a motion, how to properly run a meeting. I think, you know, it's amazing. You go to some organizations or even, you know, government organizations, and people don't know how to make a proper motion and things like that. So 4-H kids are learning that, but they're also learning how to represent themselves or represent an idea. They can get up and in front of a group and talk about ideas and give a presentation about things. And I think that's an important skill. A lot of people can't get up in front of a group and talk about their own ideas and things like that. So I think that's an important skill that 4-H provides to our kids. And it's one that I would encourage everybody to take advantage of.
Well, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a great public speaking type thing where you can get up and express your ideas. And that's one of the things that I took when I was in school. Obviously, I'm not in front of a lot of people. I'm just in front of a microphone. But again, there you have to think that there's lots of people listening. So exactly. You basically are public listening right now.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
are public speaking. It's just they're not right in front of you, but they're still out there, though. So
that's exactly right. And I think, you know, a lot of kids, you know, it's hard. I laugh because you can always tell a kid that's been in 4-H since they were 7. They have no problem getting up in front of their class or anything else and talking. So I know in Wilson County, we're getting ready to, our 4-H kids are going to help with the Wilson County Old Iron Club this week. We're expecting 2,000 school kids to come through, and those kids will stand there and talk to kids about their projects and things that are happening. And it's amazing to watch.
Yeah, that is a fantastic thing to watch. And like you said, it's like, oh, well, I know he was in 4-H because look at him. He's just getting up there and talking like it's nothing else. How does the 4-H, you said the Wildcat Extension works with 4-H.
Mm-hmm.
How do the both centers work together? Is the 4-H, is it literally a part of the K-State Extension?
Yes, 4-H is the program for 4-H program is administered through Kansas State University and through the local extension offices. So without, you know, our local extension offices, we couldn't have 4-H programming. So we administer the program. It's run a lot by volunteers, which we encourage people, if they're interested in volunteering to help with 4-H, to contact us. We'd love to get you helping. Maybe it's a specific project. Maybe it's growing pumpkins. I don't know. But it could be anything. But, you know, if you're interested in doing that, we can't run it without a lot of great volunteers. And we're fortunate in our district to have a lot of great volunteers.
And that is great to hear. And then, like you said, K-State kind of just administers, but the volunteers are really kind of like the driving force of the projects, are they not?
Sure, yeah. I mean, without those project leaders, club leaders, volunteers, parents, you know, they help get the program done. I mean, obviously, as a 4-H agent, I can't be everywhere all the time. So it's important that we have those volunteers that can step in and administer some of those programs.
And it's great to see when the volunteers can step in and help on a project and kind of drive a project. And you guys were talking about pumpkins. And the one thing I was wondering about, when is like one of the best, and this is a question for both of you guys, when is like one of the best times to like start planting pumpkins?
For Halloween? Fall decoration?
Yeah, for like fall decorations and Halloween.
It all depends on the type of pumpkin you're growing. But most of the time for Halloween, we're looking at starting pumpkins towards mid to late May. Because we don't want those pumpkins to mature too early in the season. If we plant them early, we're going to have pumpkins maturing in August.
And that's not a good thing.
That's a little bit early.
We'd like to see them turning color towards mid-September, early October. That's when we want them to hit. So early June is the ideal target time to plant. Then you have a lot of issues that can creep in when you're growing pumpkins, and the primary issue is squash bugs, and they can really ruin a crop in a hurry.
Right.
So they can ruin a lot of crops in a hurry.
They can.
So early on, watch for squash bugs. Watch for the eggs. Of course, some people with one pumpkin plant that's not too large. You can hand pick the eggs off of the plant. There's going to be a lot of them, and that's a very tedious job. I've tried it, and I've never been successful at it. The thing to do is to watch for the eggs, and watch for the little insects that hatch from out of the eggs. They're going to be small. They're going to be whitish ash color with little black legs. And they're going to typically be in little clusters. When they newly hatch, they're going to kind of hang around where that egg nest was. And then they will start to disperse and get larger in size as they feed on the plant. And they feed with a hypodermic type needle mouth part. It's called a piercing sucking mouth part. And what they do is they have a sharp beak, and they're going to push it into the plant tissue, very careful. And they're going to push a little saliva into that little pocket of cells that they've penetrated, and it's going to dissolve those cells, and they're going to slurp up the good stuff.
And that's not good for us. So.
What happens to the plant is every place where they feed, it destroys the cells. There you get a little yellow spot, and one little squash bug's not going to do much for the entire plant. But when you have thousands of them working on that plant, then it just has an issue. So the real key to controlling squash bugs is to hit them early. When you see those little nymphs crawling around, they're very susceptible to insecticide. Old publications said to spray 7 insecticide on the insects. 7 is a good insecticide. And also you could use rotenone as well. They both work equally well, except that it's a good insecticide for insects that eat the leaf tissue and not poke their beak inside the cells and or the leaf tissue and then suck it out. They completely bypass the insecticide, so it doesn't work very well. So you need something that's more of a contact type insecticide, something that'll hit them, and as it contacts their bodies, it penetrates their body tissue and kills them. The real key, again, is getting that insecticide inside the insect. So you have to do it when they're small, because when they get bigger, they have really hard shells on the outside. We call it an exoskeleton. That's a really, the adult insect has an extremely hard exoskeleton. Insecticides just do not penetrate unless you have one that's extremely potent, and you're not going to buy that. Homeowners can't get it. So the thing is, hit them early, hit them with an infective insecticide, such as bifenthrin or permethrin. Those are two readily available insecticides, common ingredients. So check the label, make sure it's labeled for food crops. Hit them early, and hit them two or three times early in the season to get rid of them. Take care of them.
And it looks like we have a few callers wanting to pop in, so let's go ahead and try to take their calls. And caller, you're on Greenside Up. How are you doing today?
Yep. Okay. Yeah, very good. Of course, make sure you check the label. Make sure it's labeled for food crops, because there are some insecticides that are not labeled for food crops. This one would be, throw that out as a word of caution. So, very good. It's labeled for orchards. Always check the label. Check the label. That's we talk about reading the label. You should always read the label before you use the insecticide. I've talked to people who've gotten themselves into trouble because they put material on food crops that are not suitable for food consumption. But it would be logical to assume that if it's labeled for an orchard, it's also going to work on pumpkins. It may or may not be effective on squash bugs. You really want to look at the label and make sure that it's labeled for that. The labels are fairly extensive. And it's fairly easy to read. Just let them know which section to look at and make sure it's labeled for that product. So I assume that your product was labeled for squash bugs. So, okay. All right. Very good.
Well, thank you very... Okay.
The transplant a flower, a perennial flower. Peonies? Well, this is a good time of the year to transplant peonies. But we're getting, I would say early October, late September, early October, and dig and divide plants. The top part, I get a lot of questions about pruning off peonies. The top is pretty well done. It looks ugly. You can get rid of it, but you can also dig and divide them now, too. It's a good time. I like to dig and divide early in the growing season, before the peonies actually start pushing those little buds above the soil line. Once you see that bud pushing, that's about as late as you can go to transplant peonies, but fall's a good time. Yep, thanks for calling.
All right, thank you very much, caller, for calling. Greenside Up right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Informative Jacob Weber and Cherry Nelson here today. And guys, we thank you very much for coming on today and talking about 4-H and talking about, when to plant pumpkins, which if we were going to plant pumpkins for the holiday season, we're kind of past that now. But so
do we have a minute or two?
Yeah, we have one more minute.
I got a question for Cherry. She talked about enrolling online. Yes. How do you enroll a 4-H student online?
Well, 4-H uses a system called 4-H Online. That's, you can find the link to that on our website, wildcatdistrict.kstate.edu. But that's how they enroll now. There's a 4-H Online system. It's connected. We can look at all their projects, all the projects, everything's listed. Their volunteers can sign up on that as well. You know, if they want to come in and visit with an agent about it and then get on there and enroll. It's important. Anybody 7 to 18 can enroll in 4-H. We welcome you to come and check out what we have to offer.
How about for the ones who don't want to enroll online? Can they enroll with you?
Well, they'll have to come in and we'll have to enroll them online because everything is online now. So, unfortunately, we don't have paper copies anymore.
Everything's electronic.
It is.
Nowadays.
It's all electronic. So.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks,
all right,
Jay.
Guys. Well, thank you for coming in today, talking about 4-H and also talking about different, twigglers and also talking about fescue grass and planting trees in fall. So, again, guys, thank you very much for coming in. It's always fun to bring you guys in and talk about all those great things.
Thanks for hosting us.
Thanks, Kyle.
All right. We're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we will have some Fox News right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF.